All right, so this is the sixth fundamental teachings class on absolute and relative, or as I call it, the dependent dimension and independent dimension. So it's a very, very central teaching in Mahayana and Zen. So I thought I would start by reading the same story that I did last time, which kind of takes you through the whole like path of practice and the different kind of realizations that we have about the nature of reality, because then it feeds really well into this particular topic. So this is a Buddhist story of our troubles and our liberation. As soon as you were born, perhaps even before, you started developing an awareness of your separateness from other beings and things, and an awareness of your basic feelings of like and dislike. You wanted warmth, closeness, or milk, but sometimes these things were not delivered to you when you wanted them. There was a very vague and undeveloped sense of self based on your desires and needs, and a sense of not-self about whoever fulfilled those needs on a timeline not of your choosing. Over the years, your sense of yourself and the world grew more complex and differentiated by the day. You realized your perceptions were not necessarily shared by those around you. You had a unique appearance and position within a web of social relationships. You had certain abilities and talents, but lacked others. You learned to speak, write, and think abstractly. You learned about sexual attraction, relationships, responsibilities, cultural expectations. You learned about not just the world immediately around you, but about cultures across the world you might never see, about chemical and physical realities you will never actually witness with your senses, about history, politics. The list goes on and on. Based on all of your experiences, you created a complex and comprehensive mental map of reality. Almost nothing strikes wonder into your heart anymore. The second you see a small animal with wings and feathers, you label it bird and recall a whole bunch of information about such creatures. You see your friend, and there immediately arises in your mind your sense of this person, colored by your history with them and your opinions about them. You know how you're supposed to interact with each person you meet throughout your day, depending on whether they are a family member, school teacher, boss, coworker, taxi driver, random stranger. You navigate quickly and efficiently through your life with the aid of your mental map, instead of wandering about with your mouth hanging open like a toddler encountering the world for the first time. Much of your day, whenever you aren't responding directly to what's happening in front of you, your mind is occupied pondering the beings and things and locations within your mental map, constructing narratives about what has happened in the past, analyzing what is currently unfolding, contemplating what might happen in the future. Very little fresh information gets in most of the time. Within the web of narratives that make up your mental landscape, you are always the protagonist. Central to whatever dramas you perceive as unfolding in your life or in the greater world, you, as a protagonist, are always at the center. As actor, experiencer of effects, or at the very least, witness. Naturally, you are profoundly concerned about this protagonist's survival, health, well-being, safety, experiences, relationships. It seems obvious you should get to know this protagonist very well and work to ensure their safety and status in the world. Depending on what happens, your narratives can cause you a fair amount of stress and negative emotions. But to you, they seem synonymous with reality. Then you meet the Buddha. He tells you to start closely examining your experience and questioning your assumptions. Watching what is happening in your mind in real time, you recognize your protagonist is not in charge the way you thought they were. They can't even decide to sit and meditate without thinking. Everything you identify as being evidence of your protagonist, or being within the control of your protagonist, or belonging to your protagonist, proves to be much more ephemeral and insubstantial than you used to think. Your mind changes, your desires change, everything you identify with changes. It's like in The Wizard of Oz. You assume there is something grand and significant going on, but when you pull back the curtain, the reality is quite underwhelming. You keep looking and begin to see the gap between your mental map and reality itself. Sometimes your mental map is proven to be inaccurate or awkwardly different than the map of others. Through meditation practice, your ability to pay attention to what's going on around you increases, and occasionally you notice something without the intervening filter of your mental map. Whatever it is you perceive that way looks surprising, worthy of wonder, bright, free from your narratives of good, bad, interesting, irrelevant, etc. Occasionally, for a moment, even your sense of your life as being centered around a protagonist drops away. This gets you pondering at a very deep level what is real. More and more, you get a sense that your mental map is just a simplified representation of reality that you have constructed based on past experiences, not reality itself. What if your sense of being the protagonist in your life? What if all the narratives that give that protagonist context are similarly not what they seem? What if they are also a construction of your own mind? This is how we investigate impermanence, anicca, insubstantiality, anatta, and dukkha in Zen. Probing boldly, you keep asking the question, what if all the narratives that give that protagonist context are simply constructions of my own mind? You investigate this not in the abstract, but by examining your own direct, moment-by-moment, day-by-day experience. Like a scientist who has taken the phenomenon of self as a subject of study. Through many small realizations, or perhaps a few dramatic ones, you recognize how your sense of self, your narratives, and your mental map of reality are just projections of your own mind. This is unnerving, but it's incredibly freeing as well. You could stop worrying so much about your protagonist. Naturally, you would enjoy spending the rest of your life blessed with good fortune. But however things turn out, you are not a protagonist marked by a history that has already been written, nor are you proved inadequate by the decisions you are making, or doomed to discover whether in the end yours is a happy story or a miserable one. Narratives created by your own mind can be changed by your own mind. Reality, including you, is free from your thoughts about it. This is what is referred to as the truth of emptiness in Buddhism. Things are not what you think they are. And most importantly, you are not what you think you are. Aware that your life is unfolding, perfectly fine with no protagonist at the center of it, you marvel at it. Your heart beats, your brain perceives things, your hands perform tasks, memories arise in your mind, language comes out of your mouth, aspirations arise in your heart, experiences unfold as phenomena encounter your senses. If no protagonist is orchestrating or experiencing all of this, and yet all of this stuff is happening anyway, Your life is largely the result of causes and conditions which cannot be said to come from you. After all, you're responsible for gravity, a breathable atmosphere, your DNA. Your body, mind, and heart have been shaped by infinitely many forces. In this very moment, when you perceive a sound, where is the boundary between you and the source of the vibration you perceive as sound? You recognize all things are self, and self is all things, no separation at all. This is what is referred to as the truth of interdependence in Buddhism. You are empty of inherent separate self nature, but very much exist as part of the fabric of all existence. Then, intrigued, liberated, you look around you and see things as it is. Reality free from your mental map. Every manifestation is complete, miraculous, and precious just as it is. You can perceive things as if encountering them for the first time. Experience them without immediately incorporating them into your self-centered narrative. Over time, with practice, it becomes easier to perceive this way at any given moment. It gives you a perspective on life that brings unconditional joy and gratitude. This is what is referred to as the truth of suchness or thusness in Buddhism. Things as it is, complete, undefiled, and precious. So we discussed suchness last week, and we had a great discussion, and I didn't have a chance to share with you my favorite passage that I feel speaks to suchness, which we ended up just happening to read tonight at the beginning of our practice. So it will sound familiar. So this is by Chan Master Hongzhi. Empty and desireless, cold and thin, simple and genuine. This is how to strike down and fold up. Oh, maybe this isn't the same. Oh well. all of his paragraphs are kind of the same. So similar thing. Same author as earlier. This is how to strike down and fold up the remaining habits of many lives. When the stains from old habits are exhausted, the original light appears, blazing through your skull, not admitting any other matters. Vast and spacious, like sky and water merging during autumn, like snow and moon having the same color. This field is without boundary, beyond direction, magnificently one entity without edge or seam. Further, when you turn within and drop off everything completely, realization occurs. Right at the time of entirely dropping off, deliberation and discussion are 1,000 or 10,000 miles away. Still, no principle is discernible. So what could there be to point to or explain? People with the bottom of the bucket fallen out immediately find total trust. So that refers to a famous Zen enlightenment story with a woman who's been practicing and struggling and hasn't really broken through in terms of insight. And she's carrying a bucket of water at one evening, and the bottom of the bucket falls out, and it just it's a moment. Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of imagining, right? Like you're like, oh, you're carrying in this bucket, and you're kind of like, nah, nah, and then the bucket falls, and then it's like you're covered with water, and I don't know. It's just like, it's too much, and suddenly she just gets it. So it's a moment of awakening. So people with the bottom of the bucket fallen out immediately find total trust. So we are told simply to realize mutual response and explore mutual response, then turn around and enter the world. Roam and play in samadhi. That's single-pointed concentration. Every detail clearly appears before you. Sound and form, echo and shadow, happen instantly without leaving traces. The outside and myself do not dominate each other, only because no perceiving of objects comes between us. Only this non-perceiving encloses the empty space of the Dharma realm's majestic 10,000 forms. People with the original face should enact and fully investigate this field without neglecting a single fragment. So, I mean, we could probably do a whole class series just on that reading, so I'm not going to go in and explicate it. Besides, once you start to explain it, you realize, like, actually it was said the best just like that. So sometimes explaining it just kind of ruins it. So, all right, so there's suchness. So now I'm gonna just one paragraph on the two truths. So after some time, you have experienced some degree of liberation due to insight into emptiness, some degree of connection and intimacy due to interdependence, and some degree of wonder and trust due to perceiving suchness. However, these experiences are ephemeral and contrast starkly with the sometimes brutal realities of life. It seems like greed, hate, delusion, violence, injustice, and ignorance mar the empty, interdependent, wondrous, and precious reality you have started to perceive and have started to trust is real. The mundane and less than satisfying nature of daily life seems far from what seems like a special realm where everything is precious just as it is. An experience of horror or fear may make you doubt the beauty you have glimpsed. Or an experience of spiritual peace may seem to promise a solution for the terrible things in the world, but then fails to deliver. Then Zen teachings acknowledge that reality with a capital R has two aspects, the dependent dimension and the independent dimension, but that they are the same reality. Over time, you can perceive how both dimensions are simultaneously present without obstructing one another. Then you do not get stuck clinging to either dimension. That is what is referred to as the two truths in Mahayana Buddhism. So, I made, a lot of the language and teachings that you will encounter in Zen have to do with this. This is like a major challenge, sticking point, important teaching. So I created my handy dandy chart of all the different ways that the two truths show up. And I've got a bunch of them here for people to have physically in Zendo, and then Ifki stuff tonight. Okay. So at the top of this chart are two Chinese characters, not that I can read them, but sure is on the left, and that is like contingent, or G is how it's pronounced in Japanese, and then Li on the right means essential, or Ri is the Japanese pronunciation. So the contingent or essential. So as we go down, there'll always be like two paired terms. So one of the most commonly used pairs of terms is relative and absolute. So the relative, I say, is an aspect of reality in which each and everything is identified and defined by relative positions and qualities. And then the absolute, aspect of reality in which each and everything is part of a seamless whole. So all of these pairs, and this is the main part aspect of the teaching, is that we want to get dualistic about them and think of each of these things as separate things. So it's very easy when talking about, you know, relative versus absolute to say, you know, in the relative, you know, you've got all these things to take care of and there's good and bad. But in the absolute, you know, that stuff doesn't apply. It's like as if they are separate realms, right? There's this reality over here, there's relative reality in where this set of rules applies, and then in the absolute there's this other place. And they're not separate like that. So, I mean, all metaphors fall down after a while, but like, I love Shohaku Okamura's pointing out, you know, the whole thing about like a hand and and fingers, right? There's independent fingers and they are part of a hand. And like a finger means nothing except as relative to a hand. Yeah, you could remove a finger, but then it would just be this digit that used to be part of a hand, right? It's all like finger only has any meaning because it is part of a hand. And yet there are separate fingers, right? So it's a finger and it's part of a hand at the same time. It's kind of like how you were looking at it, how you are perceiving it. These things are simultaneously true. And it's a bit of a brain tweezer, you know, teaser, but that's the nature of it. I really like, so dependent dimension and independent dimension is my own creation in trying to describe this. And then the rest that we'll go through are more traditional terms where you'll see these show up in many different places. So I say the dependent dimension is the dimension of time, space, and causality, the dimension we are usually and habitually aware of. And then there's the independent dimension, which isn't really a dimension at all, because it's just the right here, right now. Boundless and without need of differentiation. That kind of sense of just, if you could take a snapshot, maybe a snapshot, but okay, let's say like the whole universe is just like frozen in time for a second. And you could just kind of wander around and see everything. Like, there'd be all of these relationships and things in process and all of this stuff. And it would just be like, it would form a complete picture, a complete scenario, which in and of itself can be just, it just is what it is. I mean, if somebody was able to do that and somehow portray that in art or you know, make a VR experience of it or something, it would be amazing. Even if, you know, there's terrible things going on, it'd be like, you know, wow, look that this portrays that this terrible thing is going on. So, you know, it's metaphors are inadequate, but that's what I kind of think of when I think of the independent dimension. It's just like, it's an ungraspable right here, right now. Like the second you can conceive of right here, right now, you're still abstracting, right? We're abstracting out into the past and future. So we can think about causality, all of that, which is very important, right? We cannot exist only right here, right now, right? Like, that would be impossible. So I think about this also, I like to think of it in terms of dimensions, because, you know, like this has to have two dimensions in order to exist. Just like things in three dimensions physically, they can't exist just in two dimensions. Like, you kind of can theoretically talk about it, but it's not actually possible for anything to just exist in two dimensions. And say you are looking at a building and you say that building is very wide, and that doesn't mean it's not tall, right? Like, it's not like, no, you can't, no, it's tall. Like, they don't, the two dimensions don't obstruct each other. They're not set up in contrast, or conflict. So the dependent dimension is what we are usually aware of, and the independent is where we might perceive suchness. Now you'll see as you look down the chart, there's all kinds of things on that side, right? Emptiness, sameness, unity, suchness. And I would say that these pairs, they're not all exactly equivalent. The same way that I'm talking about these different teachings that we're going through as being, they describe different aspects of reality with a capital R. It's all one reality. But we use different words and teachings and images just to point you toward certain aspects of it. They're not just all, you know, we don't just have one word. We have many words, and some of them are pointing you toward certain things. So to continue down that traditional list, on the relative or contingent side is phenomena, all that manifests and happens. On the essential side is principle, the truth or reality underlying or manifesting through phenomena. On the contingent side, we have form, short for the five skandhas of physical form, but really everything that can be touched, sensed, conceived, or experienced. So pretty much just like everything that you can like put your finger on, right? Versus emptiness, the quality of all things being empty of inherent, independent, enduring self-essence. That is a characteristic, a quality shared by all things. We have individuality and uniqueness, the reality that no two things, moments, or beings are the same, paired with sameness, the reality that all things share the same empty nature and are part of the same seamless reality. You often hear of the many and the one, many myriad separateness, the countless things and beings in the universe, one unity, being empty, nothing can be differentiated from anything else in an ultimate permanent sense. We have difference, the relative sense in which there are effective and important differences between things, harmful versus helpful, deluded versus wise, and equality, the way in which all things are marked by emptiness, sameness, and unity, while all differentiations are relative and impermanent. And this is an interesting one, interdependence and independence. So interdependence here is on the relative side. I mean, it's a very profound and wondrous truth, but each thing is defined by its relationships to other things, and by what it is not. So insofar as it can be differentiated, each thing is dependent on all other things by definition. And then there's independence, where each thing has absolute value given its unique place within the seamless whole. Or as the Sandokai says, merit expressed according to function and place. So there's a sense in which, like, it's not all relative. All manifestations and beings are full and complete in their own being without having to refer to other things to give them their value. We have attributes, the qualities and circumstances that define our individuality and affect our experience, the unique flavor of our lives and personal karma, and true nature, the luminous, self-sufficient nature of each thing and being, based on absolute qualities and completely independent of relative ones. We have conditional and ultimate. We have mundane, the way we experience reality when we are only aware of the relative and our fixed ideas label things as ordinary or relatively unremarkable and unworthy of our attention. Versus suchness or thusness, the luminous, precious, miraculous quality of phenomena when they are experienced with an awareness of the absolute. So, the whole gist of it is, could somebody give me a chant book? The whole gist of it is, we experience these different sides at different times, and they can seem very separate and far apart. But seeing them as like two sides and walking as completely compatible is an important part of like the integration of our insight. Because as long as we have this sense that, you know, we're walking around and functioning in the relative, and, you know, okay, we have some insight or experience or know, we've been taught some things about the absolute, and that's over there, and I just think of it now and again, or I would like to go to a retreat so I can kind of feel like I'm sitting in the absolute, but then I have to come back to my life in the relative. Like, as long as there's this sense that they're far from each other, you know, there's still some kind of, I don't know, it could even make things worse. where before you had no hope, right? It was like, oh, well, things are just like this. But then you start to get a sense that, like, there's more to it than this. But then I just have to kind of, you know, walk around in my daily life caught up in the self-centered dream again. And then we can actually get a sense of longing and separation from what we have come to know. It just can seem far away. But over time, we work on integrating that until we can really see, you know, very, very easily go between them. So one of the ways of illustrating this is the, what is it? I don't even know what it's called. Like the Taoist symbol with the two,
like the yin yang.
The yin yang. Yeah, the yin yang symbol where there's like, you know, there's dark, there's a dot of light in the dark, and there's a dot of dark in the light. And it's like you see the evidence of the other. You know, even when one side is more dominant, you see the evidence of the other. So I'm not going to go into great detail about the harmony of difference and sameness, but that's the chant that we do on Sundays, is all about the relationship between absolute and relative. And there's a Shunryu Suzuki has a book about it. I'm forgetting the name. Branching streams flow on in the dark. So, I mean, just to pull out a couple lines here, this is page 5 in the chant book. Grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. So grasping at things in the world and just in the relative, we know doesn't help, but neither is getting attached to sameness, which there's lots of, and we call it the Zen sickness. Whether you have it through direct experience or just intellectually, you know, you can see this sometimes where people are just like, well, in a sense, it's all one, and, you know, doesn't really matter. You know, we're all, I don't know, there's, in the absolute, there is no good and evil. It's like, no. Like, they're two different dimensions of the same reality, right? So one is never put into, what do I want to say? One is never used to deny the other.
As the name suggests, they work in harmony.
Another translation of this, the title of this is the identity of relative and absolute. The identity, like, so, you know, they're the same. Which, let's see. Yeah, in the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. So light and dark, I didn't have that on this list. Light and dark. Light light is the relative and dark is the absolute, because in the dark, you know, there's no distinctions, but the light allows you to discern differences. So light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. So there's all these different images for how these, you know, they're two sides of a coin, they're like, you know, the 2 feet in walking, that they work together. Yeah. Phenomena exist, box and lid fit, principle responds, arrow points meet. It all works well. So, we have about 15 minutes. If people have questions or comments. Leo.
So my question is, it comes with a warning label. Ignore if you don't want to think about this right now. But I'm wondering if the show is on the right hand side in the right column, or if the show is kind of describing the whole chart. I know that's a weird question.
So Bushou is Dogen's fascicle and Buddha nature. Are you asking about Buddha nature particularly, or just
right,
like,
that's what I mean. Yeah, I'm asking, is Buddha nature is total existence, which is kind of like in both columns? Is it trying to describe
it? I would say that's interesting. It hadn't really occurred to me quite like this before, but I guess I would put Buddha nature, which we're going to talk about next week I'll be up session and Bob is going to lead a discussion. But the week after, I'll be talking about Buddha nature, I believe.
Oh, okay.
But I would say, what strikes to me right now, this might be just too intellectual, right? I probably should just give you some kind of really Zen master answer.
Everything about these columns is intellectual.
But going toward the explanatory and the intellectual, I would think of Buddha nature as being a little more like interdependence. Mm-hmm. In a kind of being like it straddles both sides. And in particular, the way that I'm going to describe Buddha nature is like, if you look at kind of, let's see, would be like, true nature, like attributes and true nature. On this list, it's like, as an individual with your own circumstances and qualities, your individuality, your experience, your life, your karma, that individual recognizing their true nature. And in a way, I mean, to some extent, it is very, very similar to this experience of the two truths and recognizing, like, without sentient beings, there are no Buddhas, right? This very being, this very body and mind and bundle of quirks is the being through which this manifests. And, yeah. So.
Thank
you. Yoli.
My question is, what is the point of all this? Like, how would I use it? How, knowing this, how does that change my life?
Well, over time, if you do get more and more of a personal experience of, you know, what I've been talking about so far, emptiness, interdependence, suchness, which, you know, last time when we were talking about suchness, really suggested everybody knows what this is. some extent, right? You know that those moments of completeness and perfection, and everything is just all right the way it is, and not in a sense of judging that, right? Like evaluating it and deciding, oh, okay, that's good, but just kind of independent of all judgment and comparison, just something looks complete enough. So we all have some sense of that. And it's difficult to live with the cognitive dissonance of what we experience in the world, our lives, and looking around in the world. And it feels like, but wait a second. I mean, surely you have moments where you think life is just incredible, incredibly beautiful, and you see examples of like the deepest compassion, and you realize you're not separate from anyone, and you're just, you know, like, and then why? Then why do you get sucked back into your karma? And why do you, you know, start getting angry or upset? Or why do people abuse each other? And, you know, so it can be like, what, how do these things fit? How do these things fit together? How can the world be so beautiful and so horrible at the same time? And then in a way, this is pointing toward the truth that how it can be both fully simultaneously.
So they can exist together
without denying at all either one, right? To just like completely being able to, in this moment, take a breath, perceive the independent dimension, the solace of like nothing is out of place. If you set aside all expectations, all comparisons, how else would it be? And that kind of, I don't know, groundedness, and then turn and face and engage what is going on. To be able to do that without it being like, I'm gonna go away I'm gonna go meditate where I manage to create a state of mind where it seems like everything's okay. Don't bother me. Like, you know, where we're just kind of trying to hide from the world or preserve our view that things are okay by kind of denying the sense in which they are not. So either, like, we kind of get sucked into either side, or we might get sucked into how miserable things are, and we cannot even believe that there's a sense in which things are okay.
So it's just a way to understand what we're experiencing in the moment, and seeing it with, I guess, different eyes or different mindset.
I mean, recognizing that this is the nature of reality, just like, you know, suchness, you know, it's like it has these two aspects. So we never get to hide out in one. Andrew.
Isn't what Yoli asked in the way that you answered, isn't that essentially the middle way? Isn't that the middle way without falling and overly intellectualizing or taking apart or abstracting each side and,
well,
living in harmony between the two? Is that not the middle way?
The middle way is when, you know, both extremes are unhelpful, and the best way forward is not getting stuck in either one, and this like dynamic place in between, where it kind of feels to me like a real, you know, living the two truths is fully embracing both sides. So yeah, so there's no middle. There's still both.
Right.
I don't know who's first, but Erica.
So is the essential good? Because like I see descriptions like luminous, precious, miraculous, but how can it be if it encompasses everything, including like all the bad stuff?
That is a very good question. Did Erica, did you guys hear that online? Like, yeah. How can it, can you come
sure.
up to the seat and repeat it?
Yeah, so my question was, my impression is the essential is supposed to be good because it's described as luminous, precious, miraculous. And how can it have this quality when it includes everything, including all of the bad stuff?
Yeah.
Like, I would think they would just sort of cancel each other out.
Exactly,
exactly.
Well, I was just going to say, I think even words like good and bad aren't really part of that column. They're in the left column.
They are, but it's true that the essential is, like, it's not just like a... It's just not a neutral blah, right? It's not just like, well, there's a sense in which, you know, when you make no discriminations, it's no problem. There's a it's wonderful and liberating. So in what sense can that be when it's not, you're not comparing, right? I think that's just like the wondrous, I think this is what Mahayana Buddhism is all about, in a way. Where we say, even when we transcend distinctions and we recognize everything is empty, the result, what is, has this... That's why sometimes it's called perfect, but to me that just... I mean, words are all going to be inadequate, but perfect to me starts, I start getting evaluative, like, well, perfect, so that's perfect, so there's no violence, there's no lying, there's no need, there's no suffering, like, no, it's not perfect, but I think of it as precious. And I guess the closest thing I can describe it as is, you know, I use this comparison metaphor many times, or analogy. If you knew this was your last day alive, you were going to die tomorrow. Every moment between now and then would be precious. Even if it kind of sucked. I mean, I think about, like, if I was going to, knew I was going to die tomorrow, and I drove home and missed a light and had to wait at the stop at the red light, slam on the brake and stop at the red light again, which usually makes me go nah, 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 nah. I would probably weep. So that's the luminous preciousness of it, right? It's not a good as opposed to kind of it's inexplicable, which is why most of the ancestors just use poetry or something like that to try to talk about it.
So, I mean, I'm pretty new to Zen, and so, like, every teaching that we do, every story we do, every time we talk, it's like, it's new to me, right? And so,
yeah.
That's pretty awesome. But when you were telling the story about the bottom of the bucket falling out, right, and I was just picturing in my head this woman carrying this bucket, maybe it's a hot day like today, and you're just like, I just don't want to be carrying this weight right now, I wish I could just go cool off somewhere. And then the bottom of the bucket falls out, and now you're not carrying weight, and you're cooled off, right?
Yeah.
And, like,
that's a good point.
How amazing is that? You got exactly what you wanted, but it sucks because you don't have water. You have to go get a new bucket and go do this all over again.
Yeah.
And to me, I mean, that's kind of what you were just saying, is, like,
yeah.
it's good and it's bad, but, like, at the same time, it's amazing that that happened to that person at that moment in time, and they got to... You know, experience the good and the bad of it.
Yeah, that's really good.
Neat. Wow, well, that brings us to 9.
Already.
Oh, no. Well, sorry. Let's see. I dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time. all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Bye all.
Thank you, Domio, and everyone.
Thank you all for being here.